Welcome to Ventures, a podcast from the University of Chicago Center for Middle Eastern Studies, or CMES. My name is Krishna Kulkarni, and I'm the CMES Outreach Coordinator. Today, I'm speaking with Maddie Williamson and Lena Zahra from the Insight Collaborative, a humanitarian aid organization working with refugee communities in Europe and the Middle East. Maddie Williamson is an author, registered nurse, and aid worker from Seattle, Washington. In 2016, she spent 3 months volunteering with medical teams in Greece, where the idea of Insight was born from her experiences with on-the-ground aid delivery. She currently serves as the president of the Insight Collaborative Board. Maddie has traveled across Europe, the Middle East, the Caribbean, and the United States as part of her work in aid delivery. Lena Zahra is a social justice champion who serves on the Insight Collaborative Board. She completed her master's in international development and humanitarian emergencies at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Lena specializes in advocacy that highlights globally displaced persons from humanitarian crises. She has worked with the Karam Foundation, the International Rescue Committee, and the World Food Program, among other NGOs. Please welcome Maddie and Lena. Could you each tell me a little bit about what experiences shaped your current perspectives towards aid work, and perhaps what experiences impacted the way that Insight is now set up?
Yes, that's an excellent question. I had a couple of very profound experiences that really shaped the way I see and understand the humanitarian sector, which then led to me deciding to change the way that I behave in it. And so when I was 21 years old, I went to volunteer in Greece. I was originally going to go for 2 weeks and I was going to be in Lesbos. And I just wanted, like everyone who saw that picture of Alain Kurdi, the little boy that drowned in the crossing to the Greek islands and then washed back up on the beach in Greece. You see an image like that and you're just like, okay, this is literally a matter of who can sink and swim. What am I doing just standing here absorbed in my own life and my own business? And how can I go and help? And so I went to just see what was going on. I had no previous experience or really any way to contextualize a disaster of that scale. So I wanted to go and see what was going on. And long story short, the EU-Turkey deal was signed the day that I arrived in Greece. And so that really changed the human flow that was coming into Greece from Turkey at the time in March of 2016. And so what we ended up doing was going to northern Greece to Idomeni, where there had been a fence put up at the border. They had completely misestimated the number of people who were crossing at that border crossing every day. And so it bottlenecked out of control very fast when that fence went up and people were not allowed through. And so I stepped out of the van into this refugee camp that was like complete chaos, to say the least. If you looked all the way down the railroad tracks back into Greece, and then all the way up the railroad tracks into Macedonia, there were just tents and tents and tents and people living on railroad tracks in camping tents all along the way. And suddenly you realize, you're like, okay, there's like 30,000 people here and 13 toilets. I don't mean anything. I have no ability to make an impact here. I don't. And so you can succumb to a mindset like that. And I think that's what a lot of us do, is when we see these large scale disasters, it's so overwhelming because we can look at that and think critically and say, okay, there's a lot of needs. How do we even begin to address them? And a lot of people just get overwhelmed and step away. And for a while I had to. That was a huge learning experience for me in really reconciling with my powerlessness, because that went against something that I had been taught my entire life. So what I decided to do is, I'm like, well, I'm good at making friends and I'm good at talking with people. And so I was able to go into the communities that we were working in and talk with people. If I could find people who spoke English and hear about their experiences, I was able to kind of say, like, okay, so clearly I can't help you very much, but if there's one thing that I can do in this situation, I want to make sure it actually means something to you. So what can I do for you? And we learned, that was where I learned the importance of actually listening to the people that are in this situation, because unless you are the one living in the refugee camp and you have your entire story behind you and your entire life ahead of you, you have no way of accurately understanding what that experience is like for them. They are the masters of that circumstance. And so it still baffles me to this day why people don't listen to that population more, when it's as simple as asking them what they need and then coming up with a plan alongside them for how to accomplish that. So that was certainly my first experience, was that understanding, but I didn't get to see that in action really until this last year that I was out volunteering, and I was in Greece again on a different in a different camp in the Greek island of Chios, and seeing how meaningful it is to people to have those trusting relationships with the humanitarian actors, so the NGOs, whether it's aid delivery, medicine, legal services, how much it means to them to have someone come and their first concern is cultivating that relationship. There's still a very top-down approach to aid delivery of any kind, whether it's, again, humanitarian aid, medical services that are not culturally competent, legal services that are confusing and not accessible. We still don't do a good enough job going and starting at the bottom tier and being as humble as possible and saying, what can we do to serve you? So those would kind of be my two biggest ways that I first noticed what we were doing wrong and then discovered a way to start doing it better. And learned that it worked.
I will say for myself, it really stemmed from a personal experience. So I am Syrian American. My family immigrated to the United States over 30 years ago. I remember spending my summers going to Syria and being with my family in Damascus. I was a bit of a troublemaker really young. I was so curious. I wanted to know, you know, why the, you know, President Bashar al-Assad's face was mounted everywhere. Maybe a little bit too curious for my, you know, my parents' liking. And just always questioned and always wanted to understand rights and the privilege of voice. And I think I really took that into consideration when the escalation of violence started in Syria, and that was when I was entering my undergraduate studies, and a bit similar to Maddie, what could I do from now my position? You know, I'm Syrian American in Ohio. What could a 20-year-old possibly do, and how could they be part of that response? And, you know, eventually I went and did a master's at the London School of Economics. And during this time, I actually visited informal camps in the EU. So I first went to Calais, which was formerly called the Jungle in France, which has been dismantled over the past few years. And just understanding kind of the misconceptions of informal or, you know, formal refugee communities, but also what was not being said, what was not being recognized. I mean, we could see firsthand, you know, police brutality. We could see, you know, xenophobia and discriminatory rhetoric and practices with the refugee community. But it felt like, again, this kind of privilege of voice. What were these communities? How did they feel like, you know, they were being portrayed? What were their journeys? What were their goals? For many individuals, it was to reunite with family in other parts of the EU or to seek asylum in the UK. And, you know, even coming across, I think what was most staggering to me was the number of unaccompanied and separated minors. So for me, it was also following the Syrian diaspora, but eventually thinking about, wow, this will impose costs for generations, and especially for these youth, you know, whether they were from Syria or they were from, you know, Iran or Eritrea. I mean, I felt like a lot of things were also very generalized, and it very much was a different experience for each individual. Eventually, I went on and volunteered with the Syrian American Medical Society, and that is where I met Maddie and began to also see in the context of Greece and Northern Greece and Idomeni, again, these concepts, you know, of course, the wonderful work that NGOs were doing on the ground, but really the strain, of course, on the resources and systems and that we're still seeing to this day, you know, very grateful to still be, you know, working alongside Maddie and in the Insight community. And again, finding, like Maddie said, those bottom-up approaches as opposed to the trickle-down to see that, you know, years on, what does that mean for populations, for example, the Syrian population, where more than half of all Syrians have been forcibly displaced. So just like the sheer importance and scale of crises and the impact on the communities and in terms of, you know, coming together and a shared humanity response and something that we're, you know, still obviously coming together and trying to work on collectively till this day.
Yeah, thank you both. It's great to hear about the kinds of experiences that led you to this work. To follow up a little bit on the descriptions of the work you did in different camps around Europe and the Middle East, you know, could you just describe the conditions of these camps? You know, what, not just the condition, you know, the physical conditions, but also the human conditions. You know, who is living there? Where are they coming from? And to some extent, also, what are the relationships of NGOs and other aid organizations to the people living in those camps?
I think that something that we do in mainstream society is paint this picture of like, oh, a refugee camp is only this place of desperation and depression and darkness. Yes, there are pieces to that where it is overwhelmingly different from your regular life somewhere else. But I think that refugee camps are not given enough credit for the light and life that humanity can bring to a place, no matter how terrible it is really incredible. So from, I guess I can sort of flex my nursing muscles here a little bit and talk about the general conditions in a camp. The sanitation is typically terrible because you just have so many people living in such a small space. I'm always amazed at how clean people can keep their living conditions, but everyone's in quarantine right now. If you're trying to share a bathroom with even one other person, it's hard to keep that space clean. Imagine trying to share that one bathroom with like 150 other people in some camps. It's very hard to keep sanitation up to the standard of preventing communicable illnesses. So diarrheal illnesses are typically rampant. When flu season or cold season comes through, it spreads very quickly. And so there's some generalized vulnerabilities that come from the environment that definitely makes you more prone to getting sick, which is unfortunate. And then there absolutely is an element of danger. People have really short fuses. People are stressed and scared. And when you're in that sort of constant stress state, that constant fight or flight state, people are going to be quicker to react, sometimes violently. And so every once in a while, there are episodes of violence and fights that will break out. And so I could tell story after story after story about a refugee camp, and it's never the same as actually going there and being there. It's an environment that at the end of the day, no photo, picture, video, anything will do it justice. But from the human standpoint, depending on where you work, but I think most people, when they think of refugee camps, what's in the news these days a lot is either camps that are like exclusively one nationality. So if you look at camps in like Lebanon, Jordan, southern Turkey, where large amounts of Syrian people have had to flee, or some of the larger camps in Africa, where it's one nationality that's been displaced by conflict and instability in their state, you won't have some of the problems that you'd have in another camp, like the ones in the European Union in Greece, where it's people from all over the world. It is very diverse. The last time I was working in Chios, I came across a Dominican couple like you. There are people from all over the world, from all walks of life. And sometimes that can cause fights, language barriers, cultural differences. It can absolutely cause tension. And then even then within nationalities, you might have tribal tension or religious tension or city rivalries like Syrians. Maybe Lena can attest to this, but it's not ever like a violent rivalry, but a friendly rivalry between like people from Damascus and people from Aleppo. But in Afghanistan, for example, like the Hazara people have been politically persecuted and oppressed for generations. And so there's a little bit more tension there. So there's always room for those kinds of cross-cultural dynamics and issues that you have to be aware of. On a good day, if we're doing a distribution, for example, we operate in 5 different languages. But if we had to, if we had a translator for every language, we could probably have up to 13. People are in line joking with each other. They're trying to talk in whatever common language they have. A lot of people spent a significant amount of time in Turkey before crossing to Greece. And so maybe between like pidgin, Turkish and English and a conglomeration of all of these languages, they're able to communicate and they're sharing stories or they're bringing a boombox and dancing. And it's really, really an amazing thing to see. So at a human level, it's very much just a sampling of civilization. It's the best and the worst of everything. And of course, the circumstances can exacerbate issues quicker than it would in other areas, but these really are just incredible slices of civilization and really cool, thriving communities in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that was great, Maddie. I want to touch on 2 points, which you did allude to, one being kind of linguistic differences, cultural differences. So when you mentioned the aspect of Syrians, you know, I also think about, and what's maybe not always talked about is, yes, you can be from Syria, but you might speak Kurdish. You know, the Kurdish population, a minority, of course, that has struggled also for their independence and their voice, you know, cannot and should not be confused with or assume that, okay, Syria, Arabic, you know, there are so many differences. Let's say if you're looking at where individuals have fled from, you have individuals fleeing from Syria that this could be a second, you know, generation of displacement. We've had Palestinians who in the past fled to Syria for refuge and in safety. So there's so many different dynamics at play as opposed to just a generalized, this is the language or this is where a community associates home and belonging. And to the point that Maddie made, that when you look at different regions in Syria, different communities identify with different things, and to kind of generalize in that sense too, can also kind of cause, you know, disagreements or confusion, I would say, and how we're in communities and in the EU, how we're responding or providing support, or even interpreters that are kind of trained in that sense. To the point of the actual space or the environment, I will say that the common misconception too is that most individuals are in informal or formal camps in areas like Turkey and Lebanon, and actually I would say Jordan. Most of the individuals don't live in camps. You know, in Jordan, 80% of the displaced population, refugees, don't live in camps. They live in urban communities. In Turkey, over 90% live in urban communities. And that also poses a risk that you're arguably so even more invisible and without that kind of direct connection to, let's say, NGOs or UN agencies that are typically going into camp. So there's both sides to looking at that in terms of, you know, being in the camps versus also in overcrowded conditions and urban communities, makeshift homes. With my work with Quran Foundation, they've come across families who have been living in abandoned storefronts and factories, and in the other context in terms of the camps, families or, you know, children in reception and detention centers that are, you know, unsanitary as well, even old military bases. So there's also just a variety in the types of spaces. You know, I will say that they're very much confined and unfortunately often closed or in the margins of society, but we also kind of can't forget that, because just understanding the nuances will really help governments, NGOs, and any other type of coalitions to understand where the need is strongest as well. I know you asked about the different kind of communities. Of course, the Syrian refugee population is often talked about, but you know, there's so many different individuals in the Calais refugee camps in France. There was actually very few Syrians, and it was a majority of Persians from Iran, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and other North African countries. So we, again, in that sense, we also have to be careful about when we're sharing that narrative or that response, and understanding who are the best actors to engage with, understanding too what these communities comprise of, and not to generalize from, let's say, a specific refugee-producing country.
I guess I'm wondering if you could compare and contrast a little bit the ways that governments, you know, across Europe, the Middle East, North Africa, have dealt with the influx of displaced persons in their respective countries. And to the extent of your knowledge, also maybe discuss this in the context of prior refugee crises. The prominent refugee crisis of the past decade has been the Syrian crisis. Of course, the Afghan refugee crisis has been going on for much longer due to war stretching back 4 decades. And even in Europe, this is not the first refugee crisis that European governments have had to deal with. thinking about the Kosovo War and other conflicts that generated really massive mobilization of people across borders. And so, you know, to the extent of your knowledge, if you could just describe the ways that governments have been reacting to this current issue and how that might fit into kind of historical policies that they have taken towards migrant crises.
Yeah, so in relation to previous crises, Greece, of course, being in its geographic location, is no stranger to this huge diversity of human flow. Historically, of course, it's been a touch point for that mass movement of humanity. As you mentioned, the Balkan War in the 90s, there was a massive amount of people moving into Greece in the world wars. In a sense, this isn't really something that's new for Greece. And what really sets this modern day crisis apart in my eyes, and being in the humanitarian sector, we really need to look back historically at humanitarian responses since they began for civilization and say, what have we done wrong and what have we done right? What worked and what didn't? Because as Lena mentioned earlier, there's no reason for us to go into a context and reinvent the wheel. That's a waste of resources and it's a waste of time. And so one of the biggest differences that we are looking at right now is that the European Union adopted the Schengen area, which means that entrance into the Schengen zone, which at this point is predominantly Greece, the asylum policy for the rest of the Schengen countries has to be done through that one port of entry. So the issue there is that, one, that's just wildly unrealistic to place that burden on one country. The other issue being that one country just so happens to be one of the poorest in the European Union. So they don't have the infrastructure, even with help from non-government organizations and global humanitarian actors, they don't have the infrastructure to be doing this well. And so as a result of that, they've had to really restrict their asylum policies to the point where it's now, in my mind, a human rights violation. And then additionally, they have this immense amount of pressure from other European Union countries coming down on top of them. And there's other European Union countries who are not pulling their weight equally in this issue. So that is kind of what sets this apart from this human flow through Greece that we've seen in the past. Another big issue, as we mentioned before, like the diversity in so many ways is beautiful. At a human level, the diversity is beautiful. I love going into camp and finding different languages and different food and different folk stories and dances, and like, it's amazing. The issue though is that according to asylum law and the definition of a refugee, depending on where people are coming from, what region, or even within a region or within a country, what city, and even within then, you know, what ethnic group, what language do you speak, what religion do you practice? Under these refugee and asylum laws, they're going to fall into different categories. And so it's not as simple as this person showed up from an unstable nation and they're seeking asylum. It's not like that. It's very conditional, depending on where they're from. They are interviewed extensively. Now that I've kind of seen it firsthand more recently, I don't know how thoroughly these interviews are actually being vetted, or if it's kind of, it feels like at this point, it's kind of a crapshoot, really. But it adds like a whole nother layer of complexity to this. So you have this issue of the diversity of people that are coming through and where they're coming from. Of course, they all have legitimate reasons to flee, but policymakers and governments are not going to necessarily acknowledge that. And then on the other hand, this insane complexity is being handled by a country and by a series of systems and organizations that don't have the capacity to be doing that very well. So the consequence is, really the consequence is mostly felt at a human level. The human impacts of this are huge, where people are absolutely sent back to their deaths every single day, or people are put into detention and completely forgotten about. The experience that I've had recently with friends who are detained has been horrifying at every level, to see how quickly people's human rights are taken away and how few resources we have to actually defend those. And what's kind of unfortunate is that unless we really go back and talk to people about their memories and experiences of refugee crises in the past, you know, of course we can kind of assume that all of this stems from human rights issues and people being marginalized and governments and policies not taking that into consideration. But I would say nowadays, what's most frustrating is that we have the technology And we have the knowledge. We have decades, generations, centuries of failed humanitarian interventions behind us, and we don't seem to be learning from that. So those are, that's what I would say kind of the main issues, the main things that set this crisis apart from others, especially in the Mediterranean region, is that there's this huge diversity, but it's being because people can move more effectively, more quickly, and farther distances than they were able to in the past. And then it's being handled by this country that doesn't have the infrastructure to do so for a much larger system than they would have been handling it for before, the entire European Union Schengen zone versus just for their own country. And then we have the technology to be communicating better about all of this and getting the resources that we need, but we're not using it the right way. So that's where, of course, at our organization, we see room for improvement the most.
Could you describe the work of the Insight Collaborative and its approach to humanitarian aid? In particular, I'm interested in hearing about what makes Insight's approach to humanitarian aid unique.
Well, I think for starters, one of the things that makes Insight Collaborative unique, and it's in our name, is that our primary approach to basically anything that we do, we try to make it as collaborative as possible. And the people that we try to collaborate with the most is the affected population. So a more common name for that population would be the beneficiary population, but essentially the people who are experiencing displacement, the people that we are trying to intervene, not just intervene on their behalf, but intervene alongside them and with them. That being said, we also collaborate with other actors that are on the ground. We try to collaborate closely with our donors as well and integrate them. We don't want this to be people blindly throwing money at certain causes and then us blindly throwing supplies and interventions at a population of people that we perceive as needing it. We like to go into situations and build really meaningful relationships with the people that are being affected, and then taking what we learn from them back to people who want to help and coming up with a wide variety of ways that people can get involved. That's kind of what we do. And then the theory behind why we do it is definitely from an educational standpoint, where we want there to be more of an understanding from the donor side of what am I giving my money to, how is it working, and how can I be actively involved. And from the affected person side, we want them to feel more empowered, more autonomous, and more involved in their situation, in hopes that that can just provide an all-around better experience for them in the situation that they're in, as well as going forward.
Yeah, really just to echo Maddie's sentiment too, when we partner not only with, you know, other NGOs and in trying to, you know, elevate these connections and messages with local and regional government institutions, or partnering with displaced communities as they determine their needs, and then just being kind of also that coordinator between NGOs and international operators. So those efforts are targeting the needs and also being used in the best approach possible. And, you know, Insight uses elements of community building, but also storytelling to make sure that these stories are, you know, authentically shown, and also, again, using the voices of the displaced communities to shape these stories, but also shape the response. I think, again, sounds so simple in nature, but something that's really crucial and needed these days.
Yeah, thanks so much. So just my last couple questions, you know, how can listeners support Insight Collaborative's work? And also, even very quickly, what advice would you give to people interested in working ethically in the humanitarian aid sector based on your own personal work?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, just visiting our website, interact with our social media if you want to get involved directly with Insight Collaborative. We're more than open. Like, we would strongly encourage anyone to get involved in any capacity. And this summer, we're going to be doing a mentorship program it's going to be very relaxed and casual. We really want to emphasize the network building and the trust component. So having like all of us come together, we'll learn a little bit about a lot of the things we touched upon in this podcast, actually, like language and context and the importance of understanding what we're kind of looking at, where we've come from, where we're going. We'll touch base about that. But then how can we work together to move forward, collaborate, pull lots of different skill sets from different individuals, and what can we create with that? So that would be a fantastic way to get involved. Fundraising is always very helpful, of course. So people absolutely reach out to us if you're curious and interested. And then as far as advice goes for involvement in this, I think that if you are someone who comes from the place that I came from, you know, explaining this at the beginning of the interview, I came from a place of immense privilege. I think that checking your savior status is the most important thing you can do. You would be amazed at how an upbringing in any sort of privileged environment can totally skew your perspective and your understanding and how it influences what you're looking at, how you're looking at it, and how you're choosing to act within it. That is my advice. I think that if you can check yourself before going into these situations and trying to reconcile with your biases as best as possible before going in, but then also being receptive to feedback throughout that process, I think that's hugely important. There's an awesome book called No More Heroes by Jordan Flaherty, I think, as a reporter or an investigative journalist. He wrote a fantastic book about what this kind of looks like in mostly like the nonprofit sector. So not just humanitarian intervention, but really any sort of advocacy, networking, nonprofit, education, like everything. So that's absolutely something I would recommend. But yeah, just being really humble, being really curious, being open to criticism, especially from the people that you are trying to help. That is certainly one of the biggest things that you need to really check before going in. There's always going to be a power dynamic, unfortunately. And so being aware of that and being humble to feedback from people who are in different components of that power dynamic is very important for you to continue to do the job well and with integrity.
Yeah, I think Maddie explained it really well. So I'll do my best to follow up with that. But I think not to underestimate the importance of advocacy now more than ever. It can be really daunting to think, what can one person do? What can one small community do? But I think we have to understand the ripple effects that can come of that, and that we have seen with different movements or different calls to action. And public opinion is just so important, and it can and it should shape policy. You know, we all have our own respective roles, whether it's resharing something on social media, sharing that with your networks, hosting something within your community. Of course, right now, maybe that looks like something like virtual, a discussion, a book club, a documentary viewing. You would be surprised as to see that just even these small movements can make such a difference, and really is how nonprofits like Insight can come to be, when we get different people involved and connected, and it becomes part of a bigger mission. And all of a sudden, we're, you know, on Zoom calls from people not just from Seattle, but we're on calls with people across the country, in the UK and in other parts of the world. So you would be surprised at these small movements, how interconnected they can be. So again, supporting, if you don't want to start something, support efforts that are already being done, like Maddie mentioned, getting involved virtually with organizations like Insight. And that doesn't have to be, I can write, let's say, a legislative advocacy proposal. It could be, oh, I like marketing, maybe I can create marketing materials. I mean, there's just so many ways to get involved. And I guess to answer previous points, the nuance of kind of what it means to get involved in social impact has really changed, I would say, in terms of ways you can get involved. And it could be in an area that, you know, you're passionate about or like, or something that calls to you. I would say for me personally, also where I am in Chicago, of course, I'm involved with the Insight Collaborative. I'm a board member and advocacy specialist with the organization. I'm also the advocacy lead for refugee and immigrant concerns with the United Nations Association of Greater Chicago. So you can always volunteer. Also in your respective communities, look at chapters that are kind of being developed there. I also volunteer with an advocacy coalition called the Syrian American Council. And, you know, we're organizing a summer film series related to Syria or refugees. So from there, I guess my advice would be don't get overwhelmed. You know, it's so easy in the, let's say, the NGO humanitarian sector to deal with, you know, secondhand trauma and just being emotionally drained. So you really have to make sure you're checking in on yourself and just showing up. You're the only person that can understand what showing up means to you. And as long as you do what you can, what that looks for you, and just being, you know, authentic and accountable to your actions and to your word, people will see that and will resonate that. And like I said, even just the small acts will have that ripple effect, and it might not be instantaneous and it might not be an overnight kind of sensation. But those building of networks and those building of movements and actions will leave a long-lasting, long-term impact, which is what we need in terms of working in, you know, communities like in Greece and like in Lebanon.
That was Lena Zahra and Maddie Williamson from the Insight Collaborative. You've been listening to Ventures, a podcast from the University of Chicago Center for Middle Eastern Studies. My name is Krishna Kulkarni, I'm the Center's Outreach Coordinator. This episode was produced by Nora Kane. Our music is by Wanis Zarur. Thank you for listening.